Let's talk with Steve Buckley. He is with The Athletic. He joins us on the telephone to talk a little Boston sports and whatever else is on his mind this afternoon. Buck, good afternoon to you, sir.
And good afternoon to you, sir. How are you?
I'm wonderful. How's it going for you today?
It's a beautiful, sunny day here in Boston. We have not had many of those lately, so I'm sitting in my back porch enjoying this great day.
Oh, nice. We've had, it's been a strange one here. It'll be sunny. It's beautiful right now. And then as soon as you go outside to enjoy it, the clouds roll in, it sprinkles. But we've been dealing with that. But it looks like we're in for a good stretch starting next week. So we're just in time for the official start of summer.
Is there a summer league team at Mahaney that plays?
There is not. I wish there were. It's been
back
in the days of the Bangor Blue Ox when Oil Can was playing up here.
I remember that, yes.
You'll appreciate this, too. I think we did a few of their games on the radio, and so I knew Oil Can very, very casually. And after a game one night, I think I was doing an interview, and he said, "Can I borrow your car?" I said, "What? What's that? Can I borrow your car?" I said, "I need my car." "Well, you don't trust the can?" I said, "As a matter of fact, I'm not sure I do." "No."
You should have just said, "I don't trust my car."
Yeah. Well, I wasn't sure I trusted either one at that point.
I never had that request from the can. I didn't know how I would have handled that one. So I'm sure you were diplomatic in your answer.
I tried my best, absolutely. Well, speaking about being diplomatic and handling things poorly, what a mess the Red Sox created for themselves with the promotion of this journeyman/homophobe Matt Dermody last week. Why did they let themselves get in that position at any time, but especially during Pride Month?
I think that Haim just did a bad job of reading the room, and I think that he thought that the conversation he apparently had with him in the spring, that if he explained that, that would have solved the issue. But, you know, again, I don't think he really thought it out. I think that he sort of fell on this you know, we're open to all kinds of viewpoints and opinions, and those are his, and just handled badly all the way along. And to have him make that start 2 days before Boston was going to have its first Pride parade since 2019, you know, they didn't have it in 2020 because of the pandemic. And from what I'm told, that organization kind of fell apart for a couple of years, and they had new leadership command, and this particular Pride parade was to have been to jumpstart something that had been going on for a long time. And so there was a great deal of anticipation, I'm told, going into that. And it was a great day. It rained, of course, but there was a lot of anticipation. And to have that coupled with the fact that their own Pride night was this past Tuesday at Fenway. I'm on vacation this week. So, in fact, the last column I wrote, before taking a couple of weeks off, was a column on that very topic. And now I'm just for a week or so, I'm working on my house and watching the games on TV like everybody else.
Well, the team is perfectly mediocre, a game under 500 after the win last night, and not much better than they were at this point last year. I guess the surprise is that the pitching, especially the last few weeks, has been pretty solid, particularly the starters. It's the offense that's been a bit stagnant.
Yeah, and we're at that point now where, excuse me, I think you'll agree, we're sort of like looking for things to be satisfied about, and it never used to be that way because the traditionally big market team, annual expectations of making the postseason, if not winning the World Series, that's what Red Sox fans have become accustomed to, frankly, since 1967.
Mm.
If you look at from the all through the 50s into the 60s, the Red Sox were a second division outfit that never contended. All of a sudden, they put it all together in 67, and they were an above 500 team that went into each season for the next 15 or so years. They hit a rut, I think, in 83, which was Yaz's final season. I think they were 81 and 81. And of course, they then Boggs and those guys come along, and they win the pennant in 86. But from 86 into the 90s, they had some ruddy years. In the 94 was a bad year. In 95, they win the division. But, you know, they've had a few bad years here and there. But by and large, every single year since 67, there's been a reasonable expectation that they would make the postseason. Now we're in this thing in the last really 8 or 10 years where they climb to the top, fall to the bottom, climb to the top, fall to the bottom. Now they've kind of stumbled into the middle, or the bottom, if you want to look just at the AL East standings. But they've been a 500 team now for several years, and that's not what people around here expect.
Well, the other thing that I think Boston fans were accustomed to is going to the ballpark or watching the games on TV and seeing stars, even in those years where they weren't pennant winners or chasing a division title, you knew you could always go see a Yaz, a Wade Boggs, a Louis Tiant, a Clemens, any of those guys. And outside of Devers, you know, it's a whole lot of guys who come and go, and the names change, but the production remains the same.
And that's a fair point because, you know, you've got baseball ops. Baseball ops, their job is to put baseball players on the field. Marketing is a different department down the hall, down the stairs, to the right, and so forth. It's a whole different collection of people. Their job is not player procurement. Their job is to sell the product. And it's kind of hard. I always used to kid Sam Kennedy that the formula I used to judge stars and the Red Sox, and he always got a kick out of this, was I live in a neighborhood in Boston, lots of houses, lots of families, lots of kids, and this is a setup to Halloween. I live on one of those streets where on Halloween there's a gazillion moms and dads with kids up and down the street. It's quite the pageant in my neighborhood. And I used to always look at the little kids in Red Sox uniforms, and I would do sort of a mental count, like who's wearing what uniform. And I remember telling him that I counted, like, I'm just making up the numbers here because I forget what they were. Like, there were like 18 kids in Red Sox uniforms, and like 13 of them had Mookie Betts shirts on. And I said, that's why you need to keep Mookie Betts, not just because he's a great player, but he clearly resonates with kids. He was above all else, he was a great player. He had a cool nickname. I mean, what little kid doesn't want to have Mookie Betts on his shirt? He was good looking. He was personable. He was accommodating to the media. He had every single facet that you want in a player that you build your reputation around and your brand around. And I think that their decision to trade him, or, if you will, their inability to extend him, is something that's going to resonate for a long time.
Now, you wait till you see that that neighborhood filled with Pablo Reyes shirts this Halloween.
You know, I will. You know, let's make a plan for November 1st, and I report my findings.
What do they do? And you've watched a lot of rookies that got some hype, and some paid off, and some never lived up to the expectations. How long can they be patient with the Tristan Casas?
Well, they can't be patient in this day and age because of what I said about the expectations. You go all the way back to when I was a kid. I mean, I remember they had the kid Luis Alvarado that came up, and he was MVP back when they had a team in Louisville. And, you know, he never panned out, but you'd always, you know, Ted Cox was a big star for like a week.
He went four for four. I remember that.
Yeah, I remember he got like a whole bunch of hits and then was never seen again. And you know, we've always had those guys that it never quite panned out. And then you've got the guys that just become mercurial, like, you know, like Nomar took the city by storm. And obviously Jim Rice and Fred Lynn and, you know, Wade Boggs, and, you know, they've had, you know, Mo Vaughn was a big star when he came along. So there was a time when you could look at the whole field, and it's like even in 07, when they won the World Series, I remember, like, you would look at the field, and you'd say, oh, Pedroia came up in their farm system. Jacoby Ellsbury came up in their farm system. They just had all these guys that they developed and brought to the big leagues. John Lester, Jonathan Papelbon. And the list went on and on. Clay Buchholz for a while. That has not been the case in recent years. And I understand the logic of wanting to develop stars and bring them up. But it has always been with the understanding that you would also build around the prospects coming up by bringing in established players. And David Ortiz, Manny Ramirez, Johnny Damon, and the list goes on and on. Curt Schilling, they made that big trade, which turned out to be historic, and it's the way it played out. So you can't just go out and sign a bunch of guys and win the World Series. The Florida Marlins did it back in, I think, 97, was it? And they went out and got Kevin Brown and Al Leiter and a whole bunch of players. And then they won the World Series. And then within a year later, they traded them all, and they were losing 110 games again. So you can do that in the short term. But if you want to build a sustainable product, I think you have to have a willingness to sign big-name players and to develop. And you can't go all in one direction, in my opinion.
Well, last year at the trade deadline, they tried going in a couple of directions. That's a tough needle to thread. They traded away Christian Vasquez. They picked up some other guys from other teams and tried to have it both ways, and that didn't really pan out. But because of that extra wild card, and I think the overall mediocrity in the league, likely at the end of July, most teams will at least still be mathematically in this thing. What do they do?
I think it depends on the market. If you're, say, Pittsburgh, and granted it's a different division with different stakes, but Pittsburgh needs to get to the postseason and to win a playoff series and to do something. For those who've never been to Pittsburgh, it's a magnificent city. Mm. And its ballpark is an absolute gem. I mean, I used to joke, God, I want to retire, just move to Pittsburgh and sit there and watch games. It's that pretty. But the product on the field hasn't been commensurate with the ballpark that the fans should be going to. So I think in their case, wherever they are, whatever they're doing, they need to get to the postseason. In a city like Boston, where they could win 9 or 10 in a row and be in contention for a wild card spot. But in Boston, unfortunately, they're in the American League East. They're a big market team. There is the understanding that they're going to compete with the Yankees and the Rays, now the Orioles. But the fan base in Boston and beyond, New England, what they see, and it's not unfair for them to see this, what they see is a last-place team in the AL East. And it's kind of hard to sell them on the notion that, hey, if we just put something together, we're going to claim one of those wild card spots. When, in reality, a wild card spot still gets you to the postseason. And then anything can happen. The problem there is you've got to have a couple of good starting pitchers to maintain that, which they don't really have right now.
We're talking with Steve Buckley here on Downtown. In your time covering the Red Sox, Buck, who's the general manager who understood this Boston market the best?
Wow. I think Theo, I think clearly is at the top of that. He had the sensibilities and the history, institutional knowledge of a Red Sox fan. He grew up in Brookline. You could walk to his house from Fenway Park. I think Ben Cherington had that because he was born and raised in New Hampshire. And he used to always tell the story about his mother would go up and buy the Sunday papers so he could read all the baseball notes. And, raised on, Peter Gammons 101 as I was. In fact, I even wrote a story once on all the baseball writers of the country who became baseball writers because of Peter Gammons. Mm. There were like 15 of us, Gordon Eads, Buster Olney growing up in Vermont, me, and just Jeff Horrigan when he was at the Boston Herald. The list goes on and on. I think there were baseball executives the same way. But I would stop that count at Theo because he really understood. He knew what to say to appeal to Red Sox fans.
All right, here's one for you. Are you a movie guy?
I am a movie guy.
What's the best baseball movie of all time?
Oh, God. I have a thing for Field of Dreams. I've been to Dyersville, like a yokel. I stood on the mound. And I think if it's not on Facebook now as my profile picture, I'll put it back up there. I'll tweet it out in an hour or so just to validate my claim. There were problems with Field of Dreams. And my problem isn't that Ray Liotta's batting right-handed. I'm okay with that. Hmm. I guess the big problem is that they have all these old ball players come back from the great beyond. Why couldn't they put Cool Papa Bell, a Satchel Paige, out there?
Right.
And you've got this James Earl Jones character loosely based on, I'm drawing a blank, Catcher in the Rye, J.D. Salinger.
J.D. Salinger, yeah.
And although they changed it for the movie, but in the novel, it's J.D. Salinger. And he does this big speech about how back when everything was good again and blah, 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 but he's appealing to a time when baseball was exclusionary. So that's an issue I have with the movie. But in terms of the texture and the feel and the warmth and the nostalgia of the movie, I'm a sucker for that movie.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, I love that. I love Bull Durham. I still I love and now I've lost the Redford
the Natural.
Natural. Yeah. I love that as well. Although, like a lot of them, the book was better.
I should point out that Doc Edwards, the late great manager of the Maine Guide, my obligatory Maine Guide thing, but Doc Edwards fell in love with Bull Durham. He said it was the best baseball movie he ever saw because he spent so many years in the minor leagues, both as a coach, a manager, and a player. And he thought that Bull Durham did such an excellent job of capturing the essence of minor league baseball, the players riding on the bus. And there were little things in the movie that are so small that you have to be like an expert to pick them out. Kevin Costner is riding on a bus and he writes something down. He's writing it down on a copy of Baseball America. And I rode the buses with the Maine Guides, and every player had a copy of Baseball America because it scoured the minor leagues. There was stories on every league, the Appalachian League, the Northwest League. And, of course, every player on the bus knew somebody on every league. And it was, you know, there was no internet, and it was a chance for them to – little things like that really, really caught my eye. The fact that they brought in the clown
Max Patkin,
the clown prince of Max Patkin. The very first game I ever covered in August of 1978, I was at the Westfield Evening News. I was 6 weeks out of college. They sent me over to McKenzie Field in Holyoke, which was the Holyoke Millers Double A team of the Brewers. They were having Harry Dalton night. And Harry Dalton was the general manager of the Brewers, who was born and raised in West Springfield. And West Springfield was part of the circulation of the Westfield Evening News. So they sent little old me to cover the game and interview Harry Dalton. And Max Patkin was there that night. And the manager of the West Haven Yankees was our own Stump Merrill. And I'll never forget that night. It was the very first professional game I ever covered. Max Patkin was there.
We had Ron Shelton on about a year ago, and he told us that in the original...
What a great guy.
Oh, in the original draft, Max Patkin dies, and they end up having his funeral at the end. But after meeting him and working with him, he couldn't kill him off. He loved him too much.
I did not know that. I did not read the original screenplays you were up on, but I could certainly see that. Max had a... it's funny because he was this big, goofy guy with a question mark, and he was spitting up stuff in the field. If you ever met him, and I met him for all 6 minutes on that night, 1978, there was a genuine warmth to him that I could imagine the Ron Sheltons and his crew falling in love with. And they even had a scene in the movie, as I recall, with Susan Sarandon. And there's like a very warm moment where she asked him a question, you know, why do you still do it? I forget what the exact words are. But I remember seeing that, and I said, wow, they gave him a one-shot. They didn't just have him running around the field. They gave him a scene, which I thought was really nice.
Yeah, and Ron said that they invited him to the premiere, and he and his wife came and were so excited because they put him up in this fancy suite in the hotel room, and he talked about all the lousy hotel rooms he'd stayed in his years going to minor league baseball games.
Yeah, and that's the thing about Max did big league ballparks early on, but his act was not deemed, I guess might be the right word, big league enough for the big league ballparks. And I know that for much of his career, particularly during the ending years, it was one minor league game after another. And later on, when I covered the Guides, I mean, I must have seen him three or four times in Toledo and Richmond and places like that. And he had this thing every winter. He would spend the winter, again, no internet, no cell phones, and it was all postcards and phone calls and stuff. And he would have Toledo lined up, and Toledo was only an hour from Detroit, and like, he's on the phone with the Tigers, hey, I'm going to be in Toledo, you know, May 9th, can I do you guys on May 10th? And Cleveland's close to Canton, Pawtucket close to Boston, so I know he was trying to line up big league ballparks, but he would always line up his schedule so that he got to do all these different places. I don't know what his mode of transportation was. I guess he probably had an old station wagon just driving around. And having stayed in a lot of minor league motels, he stayed in $10 million more than I did.
Am I right? August 24th will be the old-time baseball game this year?
It is, and we're looking forward to it. We're actually well on our way to planning it, and we're doing it for the Boston Home this year. It's a treatment center in Dorchester that works with adult multiple sclerosis patients, and one of our own players, Aiden Freeberg, who's from Arlington, Mass., who played at WPI, he was diagnosed with MS when he was still in college, and he had approached us a few years ago. He's 27 or 28 now. And he said, hey, let's do an MS fundraiser one of these years. So he's sort of our front guy this year, and he'll pitch an inning this year. And I haven't told too many people this yet, but Fred Lynn's going to be at our game this year. He's not going to play. As you probably know, he's had a double knee replacement. Mm. And of course, he looks like he's 26.
Oh, yeah.
Freak of nature. But we're pleased, and we're doing that in concert with the Red Sox, because he's going to be in their Legends Suite that weekend for a Dodgers series. So he's coming in a day early just to be at our game. So we're pretty excited about that.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, we'll hopefully talk with you more about that as we get a little closer. But circle that date, Thursday, August 24th, 7 o'clock at St. Peter's Field in North Cambridge. Steve Buckley, The Athletic, great to talk with you as always. Buck, thanks for making time for us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Take care.